From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Wall Street absorbed another body blow today as once mighty WorldCom hit the skids, the latest corporate giant to fess up to cooked books and vastly overstated profits. In this hour, more multi-billion dollar lies and deceit. WorldCom joins the wave of scandal that's rocking Wall Street. We begin tonight at the G8 summit in Kananaskis, Canada. G8 leaders met today to discuss global political and economic issues against the backdrop of a tumultuous week. Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien hoped to focus the meeting on poverty in Africa. But disagreement over President Bush's Middle East peace plan and news of WorldCom's accounting fiasco made trump other issues. Martha Brandt, White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine, joins us live from Calgary. Welcome, Martha Brandt.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Martha Brandt, give us a sense of what's going on with the leaders at the G8. Is the original agenda holding? Where's the focus?
Yep. Well, tonight there's a big working dinner, which is kind of not official, but it is where they're going to have the big blowout over the Middle East peace plan that the president presented on Monday. It has not completely derailed the talks, but certainly much to Prime Minister Jean Chrétien's dismay, who tried to keep things focused on, as you say, aid in Africa. It's been overshadowed not only by the peace plan, but then, of course, by WorldCom.
You say big blowout on the Middle East peace plan. Well, what do you mean by that?
I think that there's a lot of sense here among European leaders that they just don't have all the story. The president has been talking privately in bilateral meetings with Tony Blair and others, trying to make his case. In the case of Tony Blair, he came out and talked about he, too, has been disappointed in Arafat, and he's had some 13 meetings with him, and he's never performed. And so, clearly, he convinced Blair that the idea of dialing Arafat out of the process might work. Chrétien, on the other hand, has been much more tepid, and he's got a lot of convincing to do with both France and Germany, who are very influential allies and could be influential with Arafat.
Is President Bush, does he appear to be in a position to hold the day, to sway the debate with his fellow leaders at the summit?
Well, part of the problem here is that because they announced this on Monday and they changed the focus to really come down on the Palestinian Authority and Arafat, mm-hmm. even more than they expected, they didn't really have a step-by-step process. They still can't answer questions like, well, you say you don't want to deal with Arafat, but he's still there and in power. In the interim, do we still deal with him? It's very much a work in progress. And so a lot of these leaders don't really know what they think because they don't feel like they have all the answers, and the Bush administration doesn't have them either.
Apart from Tony Blair, has any other leader stepped forward to say, we agree Arafat is a problem and we're not going to deal with him any longer?
Well, what's so interesting about diplo speak, as they call mm-hmm. it in the Bush administration, is that sometimes not saying something is as loud as saying something. And so the fact that you don't have a lot of leaders rushing and embracing this proposal here at the G8 tells you a lot. Kofi Annan, who just arrived today, I've yet to hear what he thinks, but had been talking about, and I think this is a sentiment among many of these leaders, that the idea of not dealing with Arafat and doing an end run around him may actually radicalize elements in the Palestinian Authority.
And what about the WorldCom scandal, Martha? Egg on the face of the U.S. president? The United States is very proud of its economy, and rightly so in many dimensions, but this has not been a good run, and WorldCom continues that.
That's exactly right. Whenever the president decides to talk about something completely unprompted, you know that he's got a real political reason for doing so. And then this morning, he made these comments of talking about corporate responsibility.
Saying it's outrageous.
Right, called it outrageous, exactly, because he realizes that this does look bad for the GOP. It shouldn't necessarily directly, but because the GOP is often seen as being in bed with big business, the more of these scandals we have, the more fodder it gives to the Democrats, and also the more it shakes confidence of consumers in the market. And the president knows that if the economy goes south, well, there goes a lot of his political strength as well, despite the fact that the war on terror has kind of distracted us from the economy lately.
How do you see President Bush's personal or the U.S. agenda at this G8 meeting, and how does it compare with that of other leaders in attendance?
Well, one of the other sticking issues, he's not just getting flack about the American economy from folks here in the press, but from the leaders themselves. Chrétien and others have been bringing up the trade issue. Germany and other European countries don't really have a leg to stand on because they have very protective tariffs, so they've enlisted the Canadian Prime Minister to do just that, to bring up the steel tariffs, to bring up softwood in the case of Canada, to bring up farm subsidies. And so that, again, they haven't made a lot of progress since Genoa. It's you know, generally under the auspices of being a friendly exchange, but I think that they're really going to stick it to Bush on these issues. In fact, the Massachusetts governor, who's now the ambassador here, said that there may be a gang-up on Bush.
And what about Russia? More talk of inviting Russia deeper into the fold of G8 conversations?
Well, what's really been fascinating about this, and then, of course, the meetings we recently had in Moscow and St. Petersburg, and then in Rome with the NATO and Russia summit, is that Russia is becoming increasingly important for these international groups. That being said, the Bush administration and others in the G8 don't love the G8. There are rumors about them wanting to cancel it. The big change that the Bush administration's championing is the fact that there will be no communique, and they've cut down the size of the meeting. Of course, it's in a distant, secure location, but only 25 members of each entourage can come, and that is a big change over Genoa.
So the village, Kanaskis, is outside Calgary. How far? What's the setting?
It's about an hour and a half or 2 hours. I haven't been up there yet. I go tomorrow, but there...
It must be a resort town?
It is. It's a lodge. It's supposed to be very pretty, but we're here in Calgary with the protesters and, you know, about an hour and a half away. Very hard to get anywhere near there. They've got surface-to-air missiles just in case anybody flies over a fairly large zone. So clearly the lessons were learned from Genoa. It is a very different climate here in Calgary. Some remembrance of the violence that went on in Genoa last summer, but really that the protests have been largely peaceful. And of course, the WorldCom situation has cast it all in a new light. A lot of these anti-capitalist groups feel like they've now got kind of a point on their side. See, we told you these big bad companies were evil and low.
It's hanging on its own rope.
There you go.
President Bush must get sometimes an odd reception, though. Once again, as you say, he's looking to cut down on what the G8 does on the communique. This is the president who's not real interested in coalitions, whether the G8
right.
or any other kind.
And he's not particularly interested in international conferences, which is why they've been trumpeting the fact that they feel like they've made some structural changes to the G8. And not surprisingly, this a peace conference that was supposed to be part of the plan that he announced, that's no longer, I shouldn't say it's off the table, but it's very nebulous when Colin Powell will go, if that conference is going to go ahead. This is a president who's never really wanted to negotiate peace via conference and has often felt strong-armed into mentioning things like, you know, UN-sponsored conferences, and so this is much more in keeping with this administration's thinking.
Don't embrace the conference.
Right. No conferences.
Martha Brandt, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Martha Brandt is White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. She joined us live from Calgary, Canada. Three years ago, WorldCom, the parent company of MCI, was worth a whopping $115.3 billion. Its stock sold at $62 a share. Now the long-distance and data communications company is worth less than $1 billion. Its stock is worth pennies, and the company is on the brink of declaring bankruptcy. The scandal at WorldCom is just the latest shocker in a wave of revelations of corporate corruption and bogus bookkeeping that began with Enron. As corporate America shows its dark side, it's investors who are paying the price. Did you see the WorldCom disaster in the making, or did it take you by surprise? What do WorldCom's sins say about corporate America today and about the challenges to economic recovery? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Sterling, New Jersey, is Michael Knoll, professor of communications at the University of Southern California. He's worked for over 20 years in the telecommunications industry. Good evening and welcome, Michael Knoll.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. Michael Knoll, when you look out on the WorldCom fiasco as it's rolled out in the news last night and today, what do you see as someone who's worked for so many years in telecommunications, an industry that WorldCom took by storm?
Well, like many people, I think I'm absolutely shocked. You know, here is a company, number two long-distance company in the United States, last year, $35 billion in revenue, a company that goes back to the 60s, that took on AT&T, took on the old AT&T monopoly and brought competition to long-distance. Very successful at doing that. And here we see it now on the ropes, gripped with scandal, with the fraud word being used in the media to describe what was going on. Not a pretty picture.
What would lead a company of the size and in many dimensions success of WorldCom to take such extreme steps in their accounting that they're now being looked at by the SEC? People are talking about bankruptcy. They risked so much. Why?
Good old-fashioned greed would probably be the best reason to explain it all. You also have to ask yourself what was going on with some of the executives who were doing this. They all probably had college degrees, probably master's degrees from business schools. You have to wonder what on earth they learn in those business schools, how many people were trying to teach them how to push the envelope, how to sort of hide, move numbers from one column to another. There also was all the Internet hype, all the euphoria of the Internet, Wall Street analysts and the media all fueling it, everybody trying to make the bottom line look better and better. So you move a number from this column, take something that should have been expensed this year and depreciated over 10 years, it makes the bottom line look better. Other companies were making up revenue numbers, adding as revenue people just signing an order to buy something next year, putting it in this year's books. All this was just incredible deception. It certainly, and sometimes you might wonder, you know, is the paperclip an expense this year, or since you can use the paperclip for a few years, do I depreciate it? Sometimes things can get a little bit hazy, but in the case of WorldCom, $4 billion is an awful lot of haze.
And that just in five quarters, just in a year and a quarter, that's awfully quick. Describe to us the kind of expenses that were put in the wrong category here. They were declared as capital expenditures, which would mean a long-term investment in infrastructure, I guess. But in fact, that's not what they were.
I have not seen, so Tom, I don't know the answer to what the specific items were, so I really don't know what they were. I don't know if it was computers or switches or what on earth they should have been. But it looks, I mean, you have to give WorldCom some credit, too. After they fired the people responsible for this, they did do their own internal audit, found what was wrong, and disclosed it with the full knowledge it probably would mean the end of the company. That took some courage. Mm-hmm. So the current people who are there should not be blamed for this. It's the people who have left who should be blamed. The problem there, of course, is far too many of them leave with the golden parachute and are sort of guaranteed financial rewards forever. So there's no risk to the top executives who are viewing the company as their private fiefdom rather than as a trust to be responsible for the true owners, the share owners.
But Bernie Ebers, the longtime CEO who left last spring, didn't look like such a golden parachute. He left with $366 million in loans outstanding to the company. Tell us the story of Bernie Ebers and WorldCom. Where did this company come from, and what has been its reputation as it rose higher and higher in the corporate hierarchy of America?
Well, I would use the word courage. I mean, in terms of it, you know, starting in the late 60s, courageous in the sense of taking on an AT&T, which was a giant monopoly back then. It's interesting to think back to 84 when the Bell system was broken up. Some of your listeners weren't born then. And there was just one telecommunications company that supplied service to us. Never in its history did anything like this go on, so maybe the old Bell monopoly was better. At least we had some honesty. And we get competition. Competition means profits, bottom line, all of that, and hence the temptation to manipulate numbers in order to make things look better to Wall Street, I guess, for some people, is just too much.
Well, Bernie Ebers was a high roller. He swallowed up MCI when WorldCom looked like a relatively small fry. Was that overreach? Did we see, I guess, that it was the high stock price of WorldCom that must have made that acquisition of MCI possible? Is this a kind of, you know, a trail of crumbs that leads us back to ambition that outsized the company's actual assets?
Indeed. If you look for the patterns, you're going to see that pattern. You're going to see the pattern of the little fish, the high-flying WorldCom that nobody even heard of back then in 97, acquiring the much bigger company, the more stable and secure company, MCI. Incidentally, the same thing happened with Quest, which was another one of these upstarts, high-flying companies, who then takes their overvalued stock, just like WorldCom did, and in the case of Quest, in 1999, acquired U.S. West. Isn't it interesting? Both Quest and WorldCom, same financial shenanigans, same problem. I guess it tells us we should think there's something fishy going on when little fish start gobbling big fish.
And yet, that is a story that thrilled much of America for much of the 90s.
Yes, indeed. But now we know people were pushing the envelope. People were indeed doing the unnatural. There was overvalued stock, And overvalued stock implies to me that there was something wrong with the fundamental financials of the acquirers back then.
And here we are. Michael Knoll, stand by. We have to take a quick break. Listeners, are we getting close to the bottom of the rot here? Did you see the WorldCom fiasco coming? Whose numbers do you believe anymore? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University,
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about WorldCom and American business. Are we getting close to the bottom of the rot here? Fraud is crime. How do we squeeze the crime out of American business? And were you or are you a WorldCom investor? What's left in your portfolio? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Michael Knoll. He's a professor of communications at the University of Southern California. We're joined now by Henry Hugh. He's a corporate and securities law professor at the University of Texas. He joins us from Austin, Texas. Good evening and welcome, Henry Hugh.
Thank you, Tom.
Henry, we talked months ago when Enron was boiling about the problems in keeping track of what American companies are up to and how the rules have been bent. We've seen an awful lot come out since those early Enron days. Now, WorldCom. What do you make of this? Are we wringing out the last bad actors here, or do we still have a big wave yet to work through?
I have a feeling that we're only starting to lift up a big rock and starting to see some of the worms.
That's a terrifying thought, Henry. It's already rocking the markets and everybody's confidence.
One of the problems is that I don't know whether people refer to this as a crisis of confidence, mm-hmm. and I suppose that is one way of looking at it. But another way of looking at it is a little different. That it may not be, in a sense, this kind of misperception of corporate America as kind of a dawning realization that perhaps corporations have not done as well as they would have us believe, that corporate managements are not all 10 feet tall as they might have wanted us to believe, and that stocks may not be quite the easy road to riches in a retirement in the Bahamas, as we have been led to believe. So it may be more of a realization of some truths rather than some kind of investor misperception of what's going on.
But if all that is true, Henry Hugh, that at all those levels, American business and the people who run it have not done as well as we've believed for most of a decade, does that mean we're still sitting on some kind of false bottom here, that we've got a bigger drop to take, if we've got a drumbeat of these kind of revelations that keep coming, what are the consequences?
Well, gosh, I've got to emphasize that if I knew the answer to whether the stock market was going to go up or down tomorrow, I would be sitting in the Bahamas and we would be talking across an ocean. In terms of if you look at traditional measures of valuation, whether you're talking about dividend yield, price earnings ratios, price to cash flow, market capitalization of gross national product, all of these indicators in and of themselves have lots of problems. In terms of if you look at the overall pattern, it is a little worrisome. Now, in terms of these indicators, there's no clear yardstick in terms of saying that just because all these indicators essentially point in the same direction that the stock market will necessarily fall. The markets don't work that way. That in terms of the Japanese experience, the market, the stock market and the real estate was expensive and they kept on getting more expensive, so that in terms of, it's really hard to say, at any one point it would necessarily fall, but the indicators are troubling. And in terms of the effect on the economy, in addition to the usual what's referred to as, wealth effects, mm-hmm. right? That is that if the stock market goes up, consumers feel confident and they go out and buy fancy appliances and buy more Starbucks coffees. Mm-hmm. And reverse, if the stock market falls, the wealth effect may inhibit consumer expenditures. In addition to that usual effect, kind of impact on the real economy, you have now what's unfolding is that the foreign investors who had bought in on this kind of American story.
On a huge scale.
Yeah, on a huge scale, that have essentially sustained us through a period of massive trade deficits. That's the only thing, in a sense, that have kept us going, is these foreigners who bought the American story and put in a lot of
that huge money, capital inflow.
Right, in terms of stocks and bonds. That they are starting to, in fact, get quite nervous as they see these scandals unfolding, and they are starting to pull money out. And you see now, like, I can't remember whether today euro came close to parity.
Yes, almost one-to-one, the euro and the dollar. But you're the professor of corporate and securities law. How do we fix this? How do we get the infrastructure of trust and accountability back into shape so that people can look at numbers that American businesses report and believe them?
Well, I think that we've all heard all the standard solutions. But one thing I want to point out in terms of these solutions, in terms of greater board independence, greater board involvement, all those Boy Scout, Girl Scout type things. I think the absolute key, and one that I think is very important from both the point of view of substance as well as from the point of signaling that we are serious about corporate reform, is the expensing of stock options. That is, when a company grants stock options to its executives, that company needs to deduct, the estimated cost of those options from its earnings.
It would go right on the books, so they're not just giving them out in such ladlefuls, and so corporate executives are not so driven by every uptick of their stock price.
And in addition to that, so that boards of directors don't view the grants of stock options as free money.
Mm-hmm.
And in addition to that, the reason why I mentioned it in the context of this disclosure stuff that we've been talking about in confidence. If you don't expense stock options, in effect, the number you are presenting to investors, especially in terms of some of the high-tech companies that rely so heavily on stock options, is inherently suspect.
So there's a kind of fundamental corruption built in there.
Exactly. And so that in terms of arguments against expensing stock options, I really don't think that the arguments hold up at all, that this, to me, is a no-brainer. And I think that the executives love the system, executives who get, overcompensated by means of, these stock options and the view of stock options as free money, of course, hate for the system to change.
Well, they love it, and they've already been out lobbying against exactly that kind of change. Michael Noel, I want to bring you in here. As you look at the telecommunications industry, it's been facing a headwind for some time now. WorldCom brings it into a really ugly light. But do you see the fundamentals that are still there to support this industry if it can get through this patch?
Oh, the fundamentals are definitely there. Last year, the telecommunication industry was over $350 billion in revenue. This is a sizable segment of the U.S. economy. Telecommunications is essential to its operation, today's global economy. Almost everybody has a cell phone. Almost everybody talks more and more on the telephone. Almost everybody has some form of internet access. And now we're talking about high-speed broadband access and the need for investment in the infrastructure to create that. This is an industry that needs stability. This is an industry that needs to be able to seek that investment through equity financing, debt financing, and real earnings.
But it's got to be led honestly for all those things to be available to it. Listeners, what do you think? If trust in corporate reporting is lost, how does the American system work? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Bill is on the line. Welcome, Bill. You're on the air.
Thank you. Well, when I got my undergraduate degree in business, one of the first classes I had to take was a business law class. Mm-hmm. And they taught us about three types of companies primarily: one, a sole proprietorship, two, a partnership, and three, a corporation. And one of the first things that really surprised me, and it made me feel kind of funny then, and now I feel like this is behind a lot of this, is that corporations are LLC, limited liability corporations,
yep,
and that individuals cannot really be held responsible for the actions of the corporation, whereas if it's a sole proprietorship, or a partnership, the owners can be held liable.
So you'd like to see the burden of this kind of screw-up land right on the shoulders of the CEO or the officers of the company that were in power?
Well, you're taught that right away in business school, and obviously they put that in the back of their heads very early on, and they sort of feel like, well, I can do what I want because I can't be held liable, and all I can do is profit from this situation. And I guess I'm wondering if we might have to rewrite these laws so individuals can be held responsible.
It's an interesting question. Henry Hugh, how about it?
Well,
beyond just making them more accountable for stock options, what about somehow making corporate executives more accountable to the whole operation of their company in a personal way?
You know, in fact, in terms of what we had talked about a few months ago, Tom, mm-hmm. In terms of Enron, some of those directors and officers or one or more of those directors and officers, more accurately, face a very real prospect of perhaps a criminal indictment for securities fraud. So that in terms of the limited liability offered by corporations, that does not, prevent being sent to jail.
You think the laws are tough enough, but clearly they didn't scare people away from major manipulations.
I think that if it turns out that one or more of one of these companies, that these people end up, if facts should turn out that they deserve jail and do get jail time, I think it would do a lot to clean up the system. That is that. One of the very reasons, for instance, that the federal authorities made such a big show of dragging Sam Waxall 6:30 in the morning out of his fancy apartment in front of news cameras, and in a sense, the reason why we're focusing so much on Martha Stewart, in a sense, is the deterrence value, right? That is,
you don't want to end up here.
You don't want to end up on the national CNN with your hands in handcuffs in front of your family.
Looking grim. And yet, where was that deterrence for so many years when all this was going on? Dana's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Dana. You're on the air.
Well, greetings. First of all, Henry Hu, you denigrate worms by saying you look under a rock and see the worms moving.
Worse than worms, is it, Dana?
As a matter of fact.
We all like going on fishing expeditions with worms, don't we?
Well, that's what I mean. They're superior to the individuals we're talking about. Just as a brief aside before I make my statement, I got a statement from the Pennsylvania Bureau of Revenue today that on my $77,000 combined income between my wife and I, me with two jobs, I'm only going to get a $43 refund instead of a $63 refund. So
your sympathy for these high rollers is low?
Understandably. Mm-hmm. Now, I can just picture George Bush being very firm today for the TV cameras, and somewhere in America hidden is the vice president who's screaming, "Junior, what are you doing? Iran Halliburton." How soon is Halliburton next? I mean, where are they on the list of dominoes ready to fall?
So when George Bush says he's outraged and there be a full investigation, you wonder if it's going to circle right back into some of the folks, maybe including the vice president, who have come out of corporate America. Henry, have you watched that? And Dana, thanks for that. That's an interesting question. Have you watched Halliburton? You know, you're in Texas, so you know something about this company.
I really wouldn't know enough beyond what I read in the press. And, mm-hmm. In terms of the focus on Halliburton, I think part of the reason is this track focus is simply because Vice President Cheney was involved there. So I don't, and also because it's in the energy industry. And so, if you're in the energy industry and you're in a telecommunications industry, people are just going to look closely at you. So I have no way knowing in terms of that particular company. But in terms of the general idea that the listener just called in about, I think is really quite interesting because he has pointed out in a sense is the irony aspect of some of what's going on. Because to take one example another example of irony, who knows whether Martha Stewart did anything wrong? Okay,
doesn't look good at the moment.
It doesn't look good right now. But in terms of the irony aspect, mm-hmm. well. Remember, she's on the board of directors of the New York Stock Exchange. And the New York Stock Exchange just issued a massive proposal in terms of improving corporate governance. You know, and here she is. She's a member of that board.
Everybody's hand in everybody's pocket in these power circles. Marvin is on the line. Welcome, Marvin. You're on the air.
Hi, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
I was just thinking about how to fix the situation, and we've got probably one of the most complicated financial systems in the world, and these companies are more and more complex, and they certainly aren't getting any less complex. You know, I'd say that it's really up to the investor to fix it, either by voting, by buying or selling shares.
But how's an investor supposed to know, Marvin, if the numbers that they're getting, which have, you know, Anderson or some other accountant stamped right on the cover, if you don't have numbers you can believe, then how do you take steps to fix a company?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I think the market's already starting to take that, you know, take differentiation there. If it's an Anderson number, you know, they're not going to be as comfortable. Ultimately, you look at business plans. If you don't understand the business plans, then, you know, maybe you really have no business being in there. And we kind of forget that the conglomerate was usually undervalued a long time ago because their businesses were too complex. When you got mm-hmm. the simple businesses, those were the ones that you bought because you can understand they only had one business and you looked at one revenue stream. Well, we recreated the conglomerate. I mean, with telecom now, what is telecom? You know, it's data, it's wireless, it's everything together. So it used to be that those companies were not as well valued. And I think you have to get back to that. And then you have to look at corporate governance. You have to look at the board. You have to look at if the CEO owns most of the company, is chairman of the board, and where's the governance. Marvin, I think investors have that responsibility.
Well, it looks clearly now that if they don't take that responsibility, they could pay dearly in the end. Michael Knoll, there's been so much money lost in the last 6 or 8 months, and no one knows where that's going to end. In telecommunications in particular, do you think this is going to filter through in such a way that actually slows down our technical development of telecoms, or are we already overbuilt in this industry?
I think that's one frightful consequence of this, indeed, is that these companies now strained financially will cut back on their investment in research and development, particularly basic research, and the horizon for basic research is probably decades in the future. So by cutting back on that, the problems might not occur for many decades ahead, and that would be indeed a disaster for us. I think Marvin's comment, too, was very much on target in terms of some of these companies by acquiring so many different firms so complicated themselves that nobody could understand what they were doing. AT&T is a perfect example of that, as it tries to get into the computer business and then divests it, gets into the wireless business, then divests that, and then ends up acquiring two cable television companies for over $100 billion and takes itself into nearly financial ruin.
And there the investors are left holding the bag. Henry Hugh, last thoughts. If you had the president's ear or the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission this evening, what would you be saying about how to get this thing back on track?
I think that, as I mentioned earlier, one of the key steps would be to require expensing of stock options.
Mm-hmm.
And then in addition to that, I think that the SEC should, in fact, do as they are doing in terms of reforming certain disclosure requirements to require to be very explicit in terms of the kinds of disclosures of risks that companies face, and to aggressively enforce those new, tougher disclosure requirements.
We're tightening up the ship here. Henry Hugh, I know we've got to let you go. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Tom.
Henry Hugh is corporate and securities law professor at University of Texas. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about WorldCom and American business. Are we getting close to the bottom of the rot at last here, or is there still a lot to go? If you've been a stock market investor, where are you putting your money now? And how far does the market have to fall to find its new footing? What's the new default setting for the U.S. economy? How low will we go to find bottom? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Michael Knoll, professor of communications at University of Southern California. We're joined now by Robert J. Barbera. He's a chief economist at Honig & Company. Good evening and welcome, Robert Barbera.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. You watch the market closely, and it hasn't been a fun time. And now WorldCom comes along and shakes everything up, not just in the United States, but around the world in the last 24 hours. What does the collapse of WorldCom, it would now appear, mean for the stock market here and abroad?
Well, I think it was really an aftershock. You know, we got the Enron event. We had the Arthur Andersen case.
Mm-hmm.
And this is more of the same rather than new news.
Is that why you think the U.S. market ended up just about holding even today after it absorbed early losses and came back?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, we were talking about a company that already very much was on the ropes, you know, mm-hmm. and you can only die once. So that widespread selling, I think, was sort of a generalized revulsion at, you know, yet another example of accounting excess. But by the end of the day, the fact of the matter is that accounting excess is now widely known to have been a big part of the late 90s boom. And old news isn't supposed to be profoundly important for the market.
Well, but do you think that if there's a fat layer of excess, and it's a kind word, the word fraud has been used today in relation to WorldCom and to other companies, if there's a big layer of that that's been baked in the cake of the market as it came out of the 90s, might we have another 10, 20, 30% to go before it's all squeezed out?
Well, if we say that there is fraud in a few cases, but accounting largesse more generally.
Accounting largesse, what a gracious term.
Well, let's think about that. If I say, if the law says it's okay for me to not count options, and
mm-hmm.
if the law says I can acquire things and count them in a certain way, and if the law says that I can count pension fund gains as operating gains,
mm-hmm.
that's all legal. Now, I think it's all nonsense, but it was all legal.
But isn't the we're not in a technicality state anymore here. We're talking about the nonsense itself. There's a lot of substance to that. Even if it's legal, and we're talking about things that aren't entirely legal here, but even if it's legal, doesn't that ultimately mean at the reckoning moment that it's not adding value and shouldn't be represented in stock market value?
Absolutely. But the distinction I was making was between a generalized largesse, the three things I named were
mm-hmm.
legal
mm-hmm.
but shouldn't have been done, and fraud, right? In Enron's case, they had 800 people go down into a big trading room and pretend to be trading as Wall Street analysts went through. Well, that's right out of the movie The Sting.
But whether it's largesse or fraud, it's all bogus. It's not real value. How much more of that are we going to see? Henry Hugh told us from the University of Texas earlier, he expects a lot more worms under a lot more rocks. Do you agree? And if so, is this just going to knock the market down and down and down?
Oh, okay. Well, if we look at the market, when we had this fraud, largesse, this inappropriate adding up of the numbers, NASDAQ was at 5,100, WorldCom was at 62, Lucent was at 81, Cisco was at 81. Most of those companies are in low single digits. I guess Cisco is at 13.
But most of them fell off of those highs even before the scandal era began.
They began to fall, that's right. I mean, now some of us always argued that once you applied appropriate accounting,
mm.
it's not that they couldn't get back to where they were. They were never there.
If we hit some kind of reset button here on American accounting standards, and presumably that's going on all over the country right now.
No, that's exactly what we're doing. That's
mm-hmm.
right. But my point is, hear me out.
Mm-hmm.
My point is that we're in the thick of that, and that to sit here and say we need to have radical changes in corporate governance. The fact is, except for the fraud cases, and that's why I want to distinguish between fraud and largesse, except for the fraud cases, the information was there. I spent 3 years apoplectic about the fact that people were accepting acquisition, option expense, and pension fund gains in the way they were and believing the profit numbers and driving the stocks higher. The facts were there. If you wanted to say, hey, this is all bogus, you had all the information. All you simply had to do was be willing to say, well, the CEO added it up this way, but I think that's awfully, you know, that's largesse, And when I add it up, it adds up very differently, and I think they earn 20 cents, not $1.20, and so, I think the stock's too expensive.
So maybe we could have just read the fine print and seen what was going on, but now there's more than largesse, and
well,
there's more information than was there. Robert Barbera, stand by. I want to bring in callers in because they want to talk about exactly these issues.
Okay,
Clement is on the line. Welcome, Clement. You're on the air.
Hi. My question has to do with the pressure that the media and the analysts put on the investors by emphasizing so much earnings per share, which is such a naive and false indication of a company's progress. Yeah. So even in this WorldCom case, whether they expensed or capitalized it, really, at the cash line, didn't mean a hell of a lot. But, you know, we're so so engrossed in earnings per share, and we try to evaluate companies in this basis. And I think this is part of the problem. The media has to make some changes, and the analysts have to make some changes as to how they're reporting these or anticipating these numbers.
Now, that's a very interesting point. Michael Noel, let me bring you in here. Clement says it's not just the reporting, it's the way the reporting is interpreted and megaphoned, that the media itself has part of the blame here. What do you think?
Well, it's always easy when something goes wrong to try to spread the blame. If we spread the blame, then finally divide it by, you know, 200 million people in the United States, and there's virtually no blame for anybody. I think we have to put the blame where it belongs. Accounting excesses, these are not what I would call what was going on here. I see absolutely no problem in a company in its annual report, you know, listing as income in a separate little line pension fund. Mm-hmm. That way I can see it right on that page, and I know that's what they're doing. You know, hiding it and making it look like it's some other revenue from the actual sale of product or services, I think, indeed, is fraudulent.
It's fiction, at the least. Hudson is on the line. Welcome, Hudson. You're on the air.
Thank you. I actually work in the telecom industry, so I've got a vested interest in whether we've hit bottom in that industry or whether there's worse to come.
Good luck to you.
Well, thank you. To me, it seems that a big part of the problem in that industry is the large number of new entrants and all the financing that came in over the last 3-4 years.
New entrants meaning new companies gobbling up turf in the wake of deregulation.
That's right, and buying market share with prices that were not sustainable, low prices. And the big question to me is, as these companies start to declare bankruptcy, really the fate of the industry is in the hands of the bankruptcy courts.
What do you mean exactly there, Hudson? How so?
What I mean is that if the bankruptcy courts take a lenient view and essentially wipe the debt off the books of these companies but allow them to restructure and continue staying in business, you still have an unstable situation in the industry. You still have too many players competing for the market.
So what is that? Are you suggesting we go all the way back, not just to the beginning of the 90s, but back to a regulated telecoms market? You want Ma Bell to come back?
Well, that's also a fear. I don't suggest that, but I think in order to reach stability, we do need a winnowing of the number of actors through consolidation. And for the bankruptcy courts to take a tough hand and not allow these companies to reemerge from bankruptcy.
Just say, you're all done, close up shop, that's it.
Or auction off the assets.
Mm-hmm.
To the survivors. Mm. Yeah.
Hudson, thanks for your call. Robert Barbera, can you imagine bankruptcy courts playing that kind of public policy role?
Well, you know, it's interesting. My dad was one of the Horatio Alger guys. He started climbing the poles. He ended up the president of Bell Labs, and he was at AT&T when they broke it up. And for him, it was like breaking up the family.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of years ago, he said, you know, I had to admit that one was too few, but Jesus Christ, 256 are too many.
But is it the job of bankruptcy judges to winnow out the field of an industry?
Well, we're stuck with that because at the peak, we had euphoric investing in telecommunication companies that drove the share prices so high that their cost to capital, their equity cost to capital, was near zero.
So they could build out just as big as they liked.
Absolutely. It was complete madness. The stocks were at implausible levels, and that allowed, you know, that provided the finance for this wild build out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that the legacy of that is what we're chewing on right now.
Well, it is quite a legacy, all the pieces that fit together here. Parag is on the line. Welcome, Parag. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Sure.
I work for a small company, software company, which is not yet public.
Okay.
Looking at these news every day, I get kind of worried saying, hey, what is happening in my company?
So you're nervous that you wonder if even inside your own company there's funny business going on.
I'm not saying there is. I'm just wondering whether there might be, and how do I know whether if there is, and how do I find out what's going on?
Thanks for your call, Parag. Robert Barbera, here it is. This man is asking about his own company, where he works, and expressing a lack of confidence that he knows what's going on. What's an investor supposed to think?
Right, and that was my point, and that's why I came back at you a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that we had accounting largesse that was legal and that it was widespread, and that investors shouldn't have bought it. Analysts shouldn't have bought it, and individual stock buyers should have balked at it. Right? And so everybody was complicit in that largesse.
But here's an employee of a firm, and he wants to know.
But that's not the same as fraud. Fraud is you're misrepresenting the numbers rather than organizing them in a way that's legal but doesn't give a true picture of the company.
Well, yes and no. There's fiction even in largesse. You say it yourself, and it sounds like selling stocks here, Robert.
But wait. Now, listen. As somebody who's done this for 30 years, okay, there is no truth, right? You have a collection of facts, and you can organize them in a fashion that you think communicates the picture. Let's talk about some people who we wouldn't argue were complicit. Alan Greenspan. Alan Greenspan spent 3 years using the phrase surging synergies for key technologies and the spectacular gains from the marriage of telecommunication, the internet, and the computer.
But when you say there is no truth, fine, and yet we need to have certain kinds of assumptions about honesty and forthright accounting from companies, or else, you know, of course everything's relative, I suppose, at some level, but what we're finding out right here is people can't invest if they don't have some simple idea what's going on. I want to get another call in here. Peter's on the line. Welcome, Peter. You're on the air.
Yes. My question is the fact that so much of investment in stocks is held by institutions, 60, 70, 80%,
mm-hmm.
have professional investors and analysts. How come they were all duped by this accounting when they're supposed to be able to analyze it just the same as your guest on the program analyzes it? Why haven't they been able to see through it all?
They're pros and it's their full-time job. Michael Knoll, how about that? How do you imagine this got by even the people who are supposed to analyze these stocks for a living?
A little story. A few years ago, I went to one of these institutional meetings. I was actually a luncheon speaker. And it gave me a chance to do something I've never done before, sit down with a few people who manage multi-billion-dollar funds. These are those institutional investors.
Mm-hmm.
What I noticed is the younger types were falling for the hype, were falling for all the crazy stories. They wanted to believe it. The older timers, no, they saw through it. I remember one of them was talking to me about cable companies and how cable companies had invented this idea of cash flow, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, because it was the only number they could find that was positive. They looked at their bottom line earnings, it was negative. And this particular old-timer did not like that approach.
Well, the old-timers did not carry the day. Robert Barbera, we just have 40 seconds left. A final question. An awful lot of Americans are sitting there out there tonight with 401k money, still in the stock market, wondering what the heck to do. What's your answer?
I think if you've got the 5 to 10 year time frame, you're okay in the stock market. I think we had hell to pay because of the nonsense of the late 90s. I think we've paid most of the hell.
Well, people can only hope so tonight. Robert Barbera, chief economist at Honig & Company, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Michael Knoll, professor of communications at the University of Southern California, thank you for being with us tonight.
You're more than welcome.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by